Thank you. We have a lot to cover today, so I want to get started. Good morning. I call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, March 27th. The time is 9:02 a.m. It's 2019. We are meeting in the Senate Finance Room in the State Capitol. Please silence your cell phones. Today, this is Natasha Von Imhoff, co-chair, and I'm joined today by co-chair Stedman, Senator Bishop, Senator Wilson, Senator Olson, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Hoffman, as well as we have President Giesel and Senator Stevens. We have a quorum to do business. On today's agenda, we have Senate Bill 55, Temporary Appointments to the Court of Appeals, followed by Senate Bill 61, Commercial Fisheries Fund Vessel Owner Claims. And then thirdly, we'll be discussing the Permanent Fund Dividend Calculation today. I'd like to direct members' attention to the CS for Senate Bill Number 55, an act relating to judges of the Court of Appeals and providing for an effective date. I'd like to invite Senator Wilson to present the bill. And we are joined now by Senator Schauer. Please state your name for the record, Senator Wilson, and begin. Walk us. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Co-Chair and members of the Senate Finance Committee. My name is Senator David Wilson, Senator for District D. Senate Bill 55 is a bill, a solution to the backlog of cases for the Court of Appeals. Since 2014, more criminal appeals are being filed than are being decided. This has led to a mountain of a backlog situation that is increasingly difficult to resolve. The Court of Appeals is comprised of three judges. These judges work diligently and maintain a heavy workload, but many unheard cases keep accumulating. It's difficult to figure out why the more cases and judges are there to decide in the criminal area. Every criminal trial ends in a guilty conviction can be appealed. And the number of go through. All right.
I'm back. Okay.
Sorry.
We're back on the record.
In 2013, the number of cases ready for review and assigned to a judge was approximately about 50 per judge. In other words, judges cannot keep pace with the continuing issues if they issue about 50 decisions per year. In 2018, the number of cases rose to about 90 decisions per year. These judges, are, in fact, are issuing significantly more difficult decisions each year, but the rate to match the increase of numbers of cases designed for each decision. The legislation would grant the Chief Justice authority to appoint an individual to act as a Court of Appeals judge to the pleasure of the Supreme Court for no longer than 2 years to address the backlog. Please note the court system did not request funding or additional resources for this to address its backlog. They did not ask for this legislation. This legislation was comprised of just working through, looking at our criminal justice system, where some of the backlogs and issues may be, and trying to find a solution to address some of the backlogs with our criminal justice situation. As you see, as a physical note, Madam Co-Chair, the cost of acting Court of Appeals judge is envisioned in this bill is $274,000 a year. This would include the judge's salary, benefits, and a temporary appointee would not be eligible for the jurors, but would be a PERS employee. With your permission, Madam Chair, I just want to walk through the committee, through the sectional.
Yes, I'd like to just add that Majority Leader Costello has joined us, as well as Senator Michicki. And Senator Wilson, yes, please walk us through the sectional.
Section 1 amends AS 22.07.01 to provide an exception for additional Court of Appeals judge. Section 2 contains a conforming amendment to revoke the exception after a two-year period. Section 3 has a new subsection to allow the Chief Justice to appoint an acting judge for the Court of Appeals needed to no longer than 2 years. Section 4 repeals the entirety of the section after a two-year period. Section 5 directs the revisor statutes to catch a line items for vacancies to the selection of the Court of Appeals. And Section 6 establishes Section 2 and 4 of this act will take effect on July 1st of 2021. As we focus on public safety, Madam Co-Chair, it's essential that we equip our courts to hear cases that are brought forth and provide closure to families and situations that may be waiting for their closure for their difficult situations in the criminal court cases that were before them. And with that, I'm available to answer questions that the committee may have.
Does the committee members have any questions? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Wilson, do you know where the location of the backlogs are and where would these additional judges be located, or is that something that is going to be provided later on in the testimony?
I can address a little bit of that, and Nancy Mead is here from the court system as well to answer additional questions. But the backlog and what's currently being done to fill the backlog, this is some of the responses that we heard from Ms. Mead in the Senate Judiciary. It's a little hard to figure out why the cases for the backlogs are there in the criminal area. Every time there's a criminal trial, there's a chance for that appeal to happen. We have seen a sort of an increase of the criminal trials over the past few years, a rise in the guilty conviction rates of those trials. You know, when the Court of Appeals recently had a couple of the judges retire, and when a new judge is appointed to that, those same cases that he tried criminally, he had to recuse himself and so could not see those same cases for a period of a couple of years. So when you have new cases come on, it's really hard to get that sort of third judge to see those folks during that same time period. So it's hard to wait for those cases to sort of work themselves out with trying to get a Court of Appeals an answer for those things. So we heard that filling these cases and filling those judges have created a bit of a backlog. That's why we're only looking for a temporary time slot to fill this judge so they can get back to on track and back on step to hear the cases.
Follow-up, Senator Hoffman?
Yes, Madam Chair, do you know the location of where these three judges would be, or would Nancy Mead be better to answer that question?
There's only three judges on the Court of Appeals, period. So wherever they meet, within Juneau, Anchorage, and have that verdict. But Ms. Mead would probably be the best one to.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If the courts didn't ask for this, why are you presenting it?
It was a need that I saw within the court system, something that seemed sort of an obvious. You know, we have a backlog, and it's something that we worked this legislation. We brought it to the court system, and they said they are willing to work with this, and it's something that they need, but they're not asking for it, as they only have one request as of that, but they're not opposing of this legislation and would would welcome the comfort and relief of this legislation.
If I could continue, Madam Chair. As you look at the judges being appointed, you're suggesting that the Chief Justice goes ahead and appoints these Court of Appeals judges, is that correct?
Just one judge for a two-year period, which is less than the three-year cycle.
I understand that, but the way the system really works and the constitutionally, the judges have been appointed, they come out of a list that's submitted to the governor. The governor's the one that appoints them, and that's from a list that comes out of the Judicial Council. You're bypassing that. And I was wondering what kind of justification you had for doing that.
We already have a statute on books that allows the Supreme Court Justice to appoint, through the sheriff, sorry, Senator Wilson, we have a statute that allows the district court judges to serve on a temporary by the Supreme Court justice as well for a three-year period. And so this is just following the same statutes we already have on the books.
Madam Chair, if I could continue. As you look at the court system, there's the district courts, which hears the evidence and makes a decision. And the other lower court is the superior court that hears the evidence and makes a decision. The Court of Appeals does a whole different, they don't see any new evidence. So they're on a different level than the lower courts. And to equate the district court to the Court of Appeals, I think is maybe a little bit of a stretch. From what I understand, maybe you have other ideas on it than I do. I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, we're not trying to set up a different hierarchy. Sure. Obviously, there is that level of what the different courts do and how they make their decisions. And we're just trying to say we have a backlog. We're looking at a situation. We're allowing the Supreme Court our Chief Justice to help this backlog temporarily to get these cases reduced, try to find a way to find closure in these cases for a lot of the victims that are still waiting for the final answers for these cases. We're not trying to circumvent any process. That wasn't my intention to try to circumvent the appointing process. That's why this is just a one-time, two-year, and it has a self-repealer in the bill as well, just to fill this temporary backlog of the situation that occurs today. We're not trying to keep this thing in perpetuity. We're not trying to circumvent any process whatsoever.
No further questions, Madam Chair.
Senator Bishop?
Good.
No. Okay. We do have invited testimony with Nancy Mead, and so she may be able to answer some of these questions, but I did see, Senator Schauer, your hand was up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for that same question, Senator Wilson, as far as perpetuity and how long this would exist, could you explain the repealer section for the record so that people understand that this is not something that's going to allow the court to continually appoint a judge that they would want to do, just so that's crystal clear?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, Senator Schauer, it's trying to think of the section we just had that in. It is in Section 4 of this bill that repeals the AS22.07.007C after that two-year period, and that was for that this would not be in perpetuity, would not allow the court to keep this ongoing note established. It has a direct cost that we can calculate that cost to the time period of that. So we're trying to be very direct, very surgical in what this problem, what this bill was trying to address as a problem that we saw it. And with the court system's I don't say sample of approval, but something that will be workable with the court system. We weren't going to do anything that would impede the court's positions or try to impede their progress and workflow. And we tried to find something that would be a good compromise through the legislature, obviously, and with the court system at hand as well.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. Seeing no further questions, I'd like to invite Nancy Mead, General Counsel of the Alaska Court System, as invited testimony. And Ms. Mead was here, and I think you heard a few of the questions, in particular making sure that we are following current statute with the appointment of this judge, as well as why your department didn't necessarily bring this up to address the backlog. And what your thoughts are about this temporary judge to address the backlog in particular. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. As Senator Wilson stated, the court system did not seek this change in the statute, but we do welcome the change. And the reason is that each fall, as the court system assesses its needs or possible needs and decides what to bring to the legislature, this was certainly something that was discussed, but we took kind of a conservative approach and only brought forth one bill request, and you did hear it, changing the Homer and Valdez judges to Superior Court judges, and other budget increments that we thought were necessary, such as maintenance costs and lease increase costs. So that doesn't indicate we don't have other needs or something that would be very helpful to the court system in processing its cases, and this is one of those that we thought, well, that is a need, but at this time, given the state's fiscal picture, we don't want to pursue it. But when Senator Wilson brought this to my attention, again, the court system was very grateful for it, and so we're supportive of this bill. To clarify one of the questions that came from Senator Hoffman, we do not have a, quote, backlog at the trial court level. It is the court's position that if the parties are ready for a trial, we are supplying a judge, and we've been able to do that. Either the regular judge, or if that judge is occupied with another matter, we are bringing in judges from other locations or a pro tem, a temporary judge, to deal with a criminal trial. So at the trial level, we don't think we're any cog or a problem in the process. But at the Court of Appeals level, now the Court of Appeals comes after trials, of course, and only deals with criminal matters. It deals with criminal, juvenile delinquency, post-conviction relief, and other just crime-related areas. And as Senator Wilson noticed, this is an area that doesn't get as much attention as criminal trials, but it is an area where we do have a backlog. And unfortunately, as you heard, those three judges who sit on the Court of Appeals have just seen a big increase in the number of decisions they have to put out every year to stay current with the cases that are assigned to them. And there's a few different reasons for that. If a case is plea bargained, it typically does not end up in appeal. But cases that go to trial and end up with a guilty verdict can be appealed, and we have seen that increase in the trial rate. We were a judge was appointed to the Court of Appeals who had a conflict because of his prior position, and for two full years he couldn't serve in that capacity. So we were pulling judges from elsewhere to fill, and we have had a Superior Court judge who was temporarily pulled up to the Court of Appeals for a long term, for a couple of years, to help handle the cases. And that was successful. That person is now retiring, and there isn't really another person who's enthusiastic to take that on. And so we started to catch up with that person, but now we could use additional assistance. As the senator also said, this is just a two-year temporary appointment. And to Senator Olson's question, the court system is very supportive of the Judicial Council, and the way that judges are appointed, as provided in the Constitution and other statutes, is extremely valuable and gives us a bench that is deep with merit and highly qualified individuals. This position, if this were to go through the council, would not be as helpful to us, because that process takes about 4 to 6 months to get somebody, and we could use the help now. And I actually think that if somebody had to go through that process, through the Judicial Council, which, again, wonderful process, we're fully supportive, but it's very difficult for individuals to go through. It's probing, it's long, it's kind of an arduous application process with many interviews and background checks. And if somebody were to just get a two-year job out of it, we don't think anybody would apply for that job. And so the court system is comfortable with just a two-year temporary appointment being an employee appointed by the Chief Justice. It is not equal to the district court in any manner. In the district court, the statute that authorizes the presiding judge to appoint a temporary judge is an ongoing permanent statute. The presiding judge can do that at any time. This, as the senator explained, would expire or sunset in 2 years, and for the one-time appointment, we're comfortable that this is an appropriate way to fill that slot and address the backlog at the Court of Appeals level. And with that, I'd be happy to take any other questions.
Thank you, Ms. Mead. So Senator Bishop has a question.
I have two. The first one is, what is the number of backlogs? Do you have that off the top of your head? The second part of this question is, typically, who would the Supreme Court Justice look at appointing to this position? What qualifications and et cetera, and where would they come from? And could he just hire somebody off the street?
Through the chair to Senator Bishop, I remember your second question about the qualifications. Mm-hmm. The statute sets out qualifications for a district court judge, and this bill says that those qualifications must be met. Those are minimum qualifications. The person has to be a resident of the state, engaged in the active practice of law for the 8 years immediately preceding appointment, and you must be a lawyer. So there are minimum qualifications set up out in the statute, and those would be required for this person as well. The Supreme Court, the Chief Justice, envisions an advertisement and hiring perhaps an experienced criminal law attorney from, you know, the Department of Law or the public defenders or a person who has a lot of experience and could be fill this slot because of their experience and merit. And so it would simply be a hiring process, just kind of like hiring other employees, with the knowledge that that person would just have a two-year appointment to the slot. And with an employee as opposed to a judge, if it didn't work out or something, that person could be replaced with somebody else. So that's the answer about the qualifications. And your first question.
Number of backlog of appeals.
Oh, yes. I do have that. It'll take me just 1 second.
Through the chair.
Through the chair to Senator Bishop. The Court of Appeals handles different types of cases. There are merit appeals, and then there are sentence appeals. But in general, right now, the number of cases that have been briefed awaiting decision at the end of FY18 were 341 cases.
Thank you.
One last follow-up. This wouldn't be, I don't know if this was pertinent to Ms. Mead, but I just, this temporary judge, would it be, he or she qualify for judicial retirement?
Through the chair to Senator Bishop, no. By the terms of SB 55, they would not qualify for the judicial retirement system, which is another reason we're comfortable with it not going through the Judicial Council, but they would be treated just like another public employee and be eligible for PERS and not have the those same benefits.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Senator Wilikowski, followed by Senator Machicki.
Thank you. On the backlog, is there a requirement for the Court of Appeals judges to issue decisions within 6 months?
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski. I'm thinking, because I know that requirement, I think the answer is yes. There is a statutory requirement that they can't have a matter pending more than 6 months. The definition of a matter pending, though, is not from the time of a case being fully briefed to the time of decision, because different things happen on the Court of Appeals. For example, the assigned judge might prepare a draft opinion, and then when circulating it to his, and if they do that within their 6 months, they meet the statute, and they can sign their pay affidavit, which every judge has to do each pay period, to swear that they are entitled to their pay and don't have something pending for more than 6 months. So once they do that, though, another judge may, for example, want to dissent or concur, and so the time for that starts for that judge. So the six-month rule, which is kind of how all the judges refer to it, doesn't mean that an opinion will be out in 6 months. It means that each judge individually has to have their assignment done within 6 months. And I will add, because I'm certain now there is a six-month rule for the Court of Appeals as I consider it, that there are times that the judges miss their paycheck, and that happens on the Court of Appeals and has happened, I don't know if the word is consistently, but it has happened because the judge cannot be paid unless they have cleared their assignments that are 6 months old.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Do you have any statistics on how often that has occurred in the last, say, year or two?
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, I don't have that statistic, but I could get it for you.
Senator Wilikowski.
The Court of Appeals hears their cases as a three-member panel?
Through the chair, yes, they do.
So I'm just curious how adding one additional person would work. Would that be mostly for conflicts or vacation time, or would they sit there as a four-member panel now?
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, we have had the fourth judge, as I mentioned, pulled up from the Superior Court for the last couple of years, who's no longer there. And how they did it was rotating panels. So each Court of Appeals, every panel has three, because it creates a potential for problem with an even number of judges on a Court of Appeals, because you need a majority. So each case would be heard by three judges, and they rotate panels. So that means one judge can be not involved in the cases that they weren't assigned to, and that gives that judge more time to focus on the cases that they are assigned to.
Senator Machicki.
Well, actually, Senator Wilikowski asked two of my questions, but I'm just curious why, and you talked about it not being a priority for the courts, just wondering why it wasn't. I'm sometimes hesitant when legislators, and this is no disrespect intended, you identified a problem and brought something forward, that's what we do, but why didn't it come from the courts? It seems like it is a significant problem.
Through the chair to Senator Machicki, it really is just because the courts consider, the Supreme Court, which makes the ultimate decisions on what we seek in terms of the court's budget and any bills, which is rare but sometimes occurs, was really just being cognizant of the fiscal situation and not asking for more than was absolutely necessary. And again, they probably considered 6 or 8 potential ideas, but their thinking was that let's wait and see. We actually have 2 out of the 3 judges on the Court of Appeals are very new. One, the older one, the longest serving one, has only been there since 2012. One was appointed in 2017, and one just started a couple of months ago. So they were thinking, well, let's see how these 3 do it before we decide that this is a severe enough, you know, kind of crisis that we have to go to the legislature and ask for resources to handle it. On the other hand, again, the Supreme Court did welcome this legislation from Senator Wilson.
Senator Wilkowski, so followed by Senator Olson.
On the timing of how this statute would work, it says that there's a repealer which would take effect July 1, 2021. If the Supreme Court Chief Justice were, could he appoint someone on June 30th, 2021 and have that person serve for another 2 years?
Through the chair to Senator Wilkowski, the issue with that would be a fiscal issue. Our fiscal note seeks funding for 2 years, and that would be our intent, and the hope is that that would help enough with the backlog, and then the newer judges on the Court of Appeals will have developed a routine enough to stay current thereafter.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Mead, how optimistic are you that with the increasing cases, especially in the criminal sector, and the decreasing budgets that we are all facing, that indeed in 2 years you'll be able to go ahead and repeal this and not have to come back for another request for an ongoing situation?
Through the chair to Senator Olson, I'm not certain that won't happen. Mm-hmm. We might need 3 years to get out of the hole or 4 years to get out of the hole, but the court is optimistic, again, with the new judges and new procedures, that they'll be able to do it. The 2 years is certainly a help towards that, but I can't predict what we might need in the future, because there may indeed, from other changes in criminal laws, be a surge in trials that is difficult to determine right now.
No further questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Mead, for presenting today. We did go through the fiscal note with Senator Wilson already, so unless you have anything additional to add on the fiscal note?
Not necessarily, unless there are questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, seeing no questions, I appreciate your testimony. We will now open public testimony on SB 55. Do we have anyone online? Do we have anyone in the room wishing to testify? Seeing or hearing none, public testimony is closed. Does the committee have any further questions or discussion?
Can we take a brief at ease?
Take a brief at ease. Okay, we are back on the record. We are setting this bill aside, so members will have an opportunity to see this bill again. So, next agenda item, I'd like to direct members' attention to Senate Bill number 61, an act relating to claims against protection and indemnity insurance policies of vessel owners. And I'd like to invite Senator Stevens and his staff
Tim Lampkin to present the bill. Please identify yourself for the record and begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate you hearing the bill. I'm Senator Gary Stevens. Represent many communities that are fishing communities and many folks that are in the fishing industry. And of course, I think probably everyone at this table has someone in their community who will be affected by this bill. This is Senate Bill 61, Madam Chair. It's a couple of terms I want to make clear. The CFF is the Commercial Fishermen's Fund, and we'll also be talking about PNI, which is Protection and Indemnity Insurance. A fairly simple bill, Madam Chair. The Fishermen's Fund acts as a fallback for insurance and workers' comp. This is for commercial fishermen who have been injured on the job. It's interesting that this program has been around a long time. It predates statehood, actually. It was first passed in territorial days. It's worked ever since. One thing we need to understand is that this fund is self-funded. No state funds in this. The fishermen pay into this fund. Actually, it's a portion, a piece of their license fees that goes to fund this, and it's intended to be an insurance fund of last resort. The PNI, Protection and Indemnity Insurance, is an insurance policy held by the boat owners, and it covers their assets and their crew. The goal here, the incentive here, is to get more vessels insured and to take the pressure off the CFF, the Commercial Fishermen's Fund, so that more claims can be filed against the owner's PNI, or Protection and Indemnity Insurance, rather than the Commercial Fishermen's Fund. It's capped at $5,000. It is, I believe, a win for all stakeholders. It's, as I indicated, Madam Chair, it's occurred, it's been in existence since territorial days. It's self-funded, and I have my staff, Tim Lampkin, here with me to delve in any of the arcane details you may want to ask about. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Mr. Lampkin, I believe we have one section on this bill. So feel free to discuss that, and then we'll see if there's any members' questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Tim Lampkin, staff of Senator Stevens. Before you is a bill that originated in, well, the Fisherman's Fund itself, of course, originated in 1951. In 2010, there was an adjustment made both to the amount, the maximum amount that would be reimbursed or covered by the folks making claims for inflation-proofing purposes primarily. And at that time as well, there was introduced the notion to incentivize vessel owners getting insurance to provide some relief to the fund itself. And when we're talking about P&I insurance here, protection and indemnity insurance, it's really at its base core here, we're talking about liability insurance. And so to encourage vessel owners to get that insurance, they established the provision that you see before you that would provide reimburse from the CFF 50% of the deductible toward that insurance. And so at that time, 50% was established experimentally to for concerns of the solvency of the fund itself. And so this amount of time has gone by. They have proven to be solvent accordingly, and it's accordingly justified to go ahead and make it 100% deductible to further incentivize establishing this insurance. So I think I've covered sort of the purpose of the bill and the section all there at the same time.
We have questions from Senator Michicki.
Actually, Madam Chair, I just need to declare a conflict. I'm a commercial fishing vessel owner, and this bill does affect me. Although it's under the limit, it could have a potential effect on my operation.
Thank you, Senator. Are there any questions?
Oh. Pardon me, Madam Chair. If I could draw the members' attention to the fact sheet that should be on your packet, it should really help to address a lot of questions. And in particular, on page 3, there's some statistics and some financial and other data provided by the department that I found very helpful, and I'd like it to bring it to your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Lampkin. Are there any questions by committee members for Mr. Lampkin? Senator Bishop.
I'd just like to thank you, Madam Chair, but I'd like to declare a potential conflict as well along the same lines as Senator Michicki.
Senator Hoffman. Senator Hoffman?
Yes.
Yes, same. I do have a commercial fishing permit and would declare conflict.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Senator Wilson.
Thank you. I do also have immediate family members that also have a commercial fishing permit, so that could also benefit or harm from this bill as well.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do not have a conflict. I would throw that out there, but I do have a question.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you. I know Senator Stevens just said there's no cost to the state, but there is a fiscal note, so could you or perhaps your aide go through what cost there actually is to the state and explain how the fiscal note, just the small impact, obviously, but how those coincide?
Thank you, Senator Schauer. I'll ask him to do that, but before we go on, I need to explain that I at one time had a conflict, having invested and lost a lot of money in three crab and shrimp boats, and I'm glad to say I'm no longer involved in that business. Thank you.
Tim. Thank you, Senator Stevens.
Through the Chair, Senator Schauer, I draw your attention to the fiscal note on page 2, the analysis there. It indicates that, you know, it is an estimate. Because we're going from 50% to 100%, they can only expect that when they do have claims, and by the way, those claims have been decreasing, I think, at least theoretically, because of the incentive for having P&I insurance, and more folks are getting that insurance, and so the liabilities are falling to those respective policies and less so on the CFF. But nonetheless, because the deductible or the reimbursement would go from 50% to 100% is because therefore reflects a modest fiscal note covered by the fund itself. And accordingly, they are solvent and do not expect that that would endanger the solvency of the fund.
Any other questions? We do have invited testimony here. Seeing none, thank you, Senator Stevens, and thank you, Mr. Lampkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We do have Renee Allward on the phone, District 3 representative from Homer, Fishermen's Fund Advisory and Appeals Council. Ms. Allward, are you with us?
I am. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please state your name for the record and begin your invited testimony.
Indeed. My name is Renee Allward. I'm calling in from Homer, and as you stated, I'm the District 3 representative for the Fishermen's Fund Advisory and Appeals Council. I had a whole little thing written up, but Senator Stevens and Tim Lampkin did a great job with the history of the fund and what our motivation is here and how it is a, this is a great thing, basically, for us. The Advisory and Appeals Council members have supported the change since it was brought up a few years ago, and we voted unanimously in favor of it. The health of our dedicated fund is strong, and as was noted, the benefits of this fund are fully financed from each commercial crew member license and permit fee. Also, statistically, the number of fish fund claims each year has steadily declined. And I think probably on the notes that y'all received, you'll see that in terms of the numbers. We hope, of course, that better safety measures in the industry have contributed to this, but the one big change that we've been thinking is that vessel and site owners are carrying their own P&I insurance, and injured crew are receiving treatment through the P&I claims. So since the fund was established to be a source of support for the health of the commercial fishing industry, this proposed amendment would continue with that mission as the times are changing. The council discussed it at length, and we absolutely support Senate Bill 61, and we feel this is a positive bill that will not affect the financial status of our fund significantly while we still continue to fulfill the fund's duties to our fishing community, as was set out in 1951.
Thank you, Ms. Allward. Are there any questions by committee members? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. We do have two other invited testimony. Do we have Mr. Bob Kehoe here? He's the executive director of the Purse Seine Vessel Owners Association. Thank you for coming to the table. Please state your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Kehoe, as you said, executive director of the Purse Seine Vessel Owners Association. Also serve as the Vice President of United Fishermen of Alaska, and the Executive Director Francis Leach will be testifying as well. So Purse Seine Vessel Owners Association is a commercial fishing trade association representing the small boat fleet operating throughout Alaska and the West Coast. Among other things, PSBOA manages three fisherman-owned marine insurance pools, which include approximately 900 member vessels. All profits generated by these marine insurance pools are distributed back to membership, which helps to keep down the cost of hull and liability insurance. And you heard Mr. Lampkin reference to protection and indemnity is kind of a fancy word for liability insurance. So, our organization strongly supports Senate Bill 61, and we thank Senator Stevens for sponsoring it. The bill expands upon the legislature's effort in 2010 to provide a financial incentive to vessel owners to obtain insurance to fully cover their crew members in the event of an injury. Vessel owners are not required by law to carry insurance for their crew members, which is different than shoreside employers who are required by law to insure their employees under the state workers' compensation system. In addition, the cost of vessel insurance is relatively high compared to rates paid by shoreside employers, mainly because of the risk involved and also kind of the unique legal framework which is governs. General federal maritime law as opposed to state law. So, for example, the cost of a purse-seine operation, a purse-seine operation typically has four crew members. The cost of insuring the crew member can be as high as $400 per man per month. As small independent business owners, the cost of liability insurance is a major fixed cost. This bill will ease the financial burden on vessel owners in paying the cost of insurance, i.e., in the event of a claim, they would get all their deductible back up to $5,000, and will further promote the goal of ensuring all of the medical needs of an injured crew member are satisfied. So with that, Madam Chair, I conclude my testimony. Happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kehoe. I appreciate it. Any questions? Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, just do you have a sense of how many vessel owners have P&I insurance?
I would be purely speculating, and quite honestly, Senator, there's not a lot of good data on that. I think, you know, the Department of Labor theoretically could do a survey of that, but to my knowledge, I'm not sure that they have. But our intent, obviously, is to there certainly are people that are not insured, which is unfortunate, and but it's a cost game. So I don't have a better answer for you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kehoe.
Okay, thank you.
Our third invited testimony is Mr. Francis Leach, Executive Director, United Fishermen of, Ms. Francis Leach. I apologize, I did not see you there. Executive Director, United Fishermen of Alaska.
No worries, it happens a lot. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Francis Leach, and I'm the Executive Director of United Fishermen of Alaska. UFA is a statewide commercial fishing trade organization, and we represent 35 fishing organizations and hundreds of fishermen and crew throughout the state waters. We would like to go on record in support of Senate Bill 61, and we thank Senator Stevens for bringing this bill forward. Crew members working on commercial fishing vessels are not covered under Alaska's workers' compensation system. If a crew member becomes injured while working on a vessel, they are entitled to receive benefits from their employer as established under maritime law. These benefits include payment of a crew member's medical bills for treatment of work-related injuries. This bill provides additional financial incentive for vessel owners to purchase P&I insurance for crew members in order to cover the full cost of an injured crew member's medical care in the event of an injury, which often happens on fishing boats, although many the testifiers before me have said that they are decreasing, which is good. By doing this, it would rely, instead of relying on the Fisherman's Fund, which would be the intended, which is intended to be the payer of last resort. In closing, we have supported a letter of support for this bill, and I believe that has been provided to you, and thank you for this opportunity. And I would like to add a comment based on Mr. Kehoe's previous question about how many are covered. I don't have those numbers, but I can say that out of several commercial fishermen that I know, many of them do not have it, including my father.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Any questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe you're not the person to have asked this, Ms. Leach, but what kind of, when they have a claim, what amount are you talking about? Are you talking about tens of thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars? Or just give me an idea of what's kind of the average claim that a fisherman has when he gets hurt or even if he dies?
I think it really depends on the injury. Mm-hmm. It could be everything from, you know, getting a hook in your hand or your finger smashed to horrible injuries, near catastrophic injuries. I do know of a commercial crew member who was injured 2 summers ago. He actually got an infection via quill fish poke. And his medical bills were over the millions because he had to be put in a medically induced coma for several months. So they range is, sure, I guess, the answer.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
So at this time, we will open public testimony for Senate Bill 61. Do we have anyone online waiting to testify? No. Do we have anyone in the galley wishing to testify? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. We do have the following people available for questions. Mr. Gray Mitchell, Division Director, Workers' Compensation, Department of Labor and Commerce. I think we'd like to move to Senator Wilikowski.
I could ask Mr. Mitchell, Gray Mitchell, a question.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. Could you please state your name for the record when you're ready, and then Senator Wilikowski can ask his question.
Good morning. Gray Mitchell, Director, Division of Workers' Compensation.
Thank you.
Senator Wilikowski.
If you could just briefly describe how, what kind of benefits are available to an injured commercial fisherman when there's no insurance, and what the maximum allowable is under the Fisherman's Fund?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. The Fisherman's Fund provides a benefit of up to $10,000 for medical costs. That could include travel costs related to medical treatment. As I think we all know, $10,000 doesn't go very far. And so the idea that this bill would incentivize commercial fishers to vessel owners to acquire P&I policies, protection and indemnity policies, because they'll be able to get a bigger portion of their deductible paid, is a positive thing for the fishermen because they won't be limited to the $10,000 cap. But in addition, the P&I policies provide a broader range of coverage, not just medical costs, but actually lost wages too. So the P&I policy is more of a workers' comp comparable type of coverage. The Fisherman's Fund is really a basic, bare bones, sort of last resort type of coverage because commercial fishermen otherwise are not covered by workers' compensation.
Senator Wilikowski, follow-up.
Do you have any data? Are you familiar with how many fishermen are getting injured and are not getting their benefits taken care of?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, the number of claims that the Fisherman's Fund receives is about 300 per year. We did our fiscal note analysis of the number of claims that are filed through P&I policies where the vessel owner has requested a reimbursement of the deductible. And that number for the period from FY14 to FY17 was just 7 claims per year. So the number of claims that are coming in against the Fisherman's Fund for P&I policyholders is actually quite low. The overwhelming majority of that 300 or so claims per year is from uninsured individuals filing claims against the Fisherman's Fund.
Thank you very much. Senator Wilson, or Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just so I'm clear in my mind, if you've had 300 claims that are there, how many of those have you paid out on?
I believe all of them.
Really?
Yes.
So everybody that files a claim, you pay out?
Those are, well, those are the claims that are paid. So I don't have a number for the total. You know, I could get that for you, though.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
If there's any committee members with questions, please send them to my office, and then we can consolidate them and send them to the appropriate folks. Senator Bishop, I believe we have a fiscal note. I know that they've talked about it before, but could you be so kind to be a little bit more detailed with it, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Department of Labor and Workforce Development, the appropriation, workers' compensation, the allocations to the Fisherman's Fund, OMB component numbers 343, annual impact of $16,100 in DGF from the Fisherman's Fund. That's 1032 for the identifier for the code. This projection is based on an average for these types of claims filed between the years FY14 and FY17 of 7 claims per year at an average cost per claim of $2,300. Assuming that the $2,300 is 50% of the deductible, then the total would be $4,600. Under this scenario, the cost increase to the Fisherman's Fund would be $2,300 per claim for a total of $16,100 per year. There is sufficient revenue in the Fisherman's Fund to cover this increased liability, and if the Chair's indulgence of Mr. Mitchell could just tell the committee the balance in the fund.
Through the Chair, the Fisherman's Fund currently has a balance of over $11 million.
Thank you. We are setting Senate Bill 61 aside for further review. Please let my office know as soon as possible if you have any concerns, amendments, or questions. So at this time, we're going to take a quick brief at ease to distribute materials and get the projector up and running.
Thank you. We're back on the record. So as we build the budget and go through the process, this committee is evaluating many different inputs simultaneously. We've heard from the Department of Revenue. We've heard from various different agencies. We've talked about our debt. We've talked about our retirement. And today, we're going to talk about the permanent fund dividend. When we look at our revenue, we look at our different industries from oil and mining and tourism, and we passed last year something called the POMV, which is the percent of market value. We passed it fiscal year 19 is the first time that we've taken a structured draw from the permanent fund. For the last couple of years, as we've set the budget with our previous administration, the statute calculating the permanent fund dividend was ignored, and instead, the dividend was negotiated separately and specifically among the legislature and the governor. And it has become a focal point and is affecting campaigns and distracting legislators from other important work. So the question is how do we make sure as we move forward that we have enough money to pay both the dividend as well as all the other necessary government functions, such as all the agencies, education, health care, corrections, safety. Then we have a capital budget that's been pretty anemic the last few years. We have debt service. We have retirement. And the question is how should the dividend be calculated to reflect this new revenue source, which is the POMV? So to frame the discussion today, we're going to look at a few items. What is a POMV? And then we're going to compare that to what is the current calculation of the dividend? Why should we be even having this discussion? What is a split? What does that mean? And then we're going to discuss the magnitude and the interplay between the dividend and the core government services within the POMB. So we have our first slide here, and I created some of these slides just to help us walk through the discussion. So we passed a POMV, which is a percent of market value, last year. What is that? For discussion purposes, I created this table. And starting in 2010, going through to 2023, you look to the corpus, the amount of the principal in the fund, and this is taken all the way through 2018, 2019 from the permanent fund, Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. And then you have the earnings reserve account, and those are accounted for differently. What you do is you take the corpus and the earnings reserve, and you add them up, and you get the total permanent fund value for each given year. You subtract the Amaretto Hess, which is a historical, it's due to a lawsuit from a few years ago. Then you get the five-year average. So starting in 2016, the five-year average is $41.5 billion, and that is taking 2015, 14, 13, 12, 11, and 10, and dividing it by 5. It's the five-year average. And as you go forward in 2017, that's the previous five-year average, 2018, the previous five-year average from there. Then you go to the right, and you see the draw percent. We passed with Senate Bill 26, 5.25 draw for fiscal years 19, 20, and 21, dropping down to 5% in fiscal year 2022 going forward. So you can see what the draw amount is, the final right-hand side. This year that we're in now is $2.7 billion. 2020, which we're looking at, is $2.9293 billion. And then you can see the estimates going forward in blue. So that's the calculation and how it works. Next slide. Oh, we have comment question with Senator Steadman.
Yes, I'm just kind of curious, Madam Chairman, maybe for those watching this, why do we have 5.25% versus 10% versus some other number? And why are we averaging these rather than just taking, you know, last year's number or last month's market value or whatever? So can you give me a little history of why the structure exists, and is this a structure that is germane just to Alaska or the permanent fund, or is this some concept that's been used around the investment universe for quite some time and has a lot of historical results that we could benchmark against?
So thank you, Senator Stedman. In regards to why we did this will be discussed a little bit later in the presentation. But in a nutshell, this was done to in order to create a controlled and disciplined draw on the permanent fund. In regards to the 5%, generally when you look across the universe of foundations, endowments, and sovereign funds, both in the United States as well as worldwide, there's generally between a 4.5% to 5% draw on what we call the market value. And they look at generally a 5-year trailing market value. This is a common mechanism and framework in order to average out and smooth out the peaks and valleys of income, of growth, of market returns, and so forth. The 5% allows for a healthy withdrawal from the fund for income, but it also allows over time the fund to grow. Because generally, if you have a diverse portfolio in stocks, bonds, private equity, real estate, among other things, historical growth with Callan and Associates, which is the investment firm helping providing investment advice for the permanent fund, estimates between 6.25% and 6.5% over time return. So 5.25% was to help us get over our fiscal hump, dropping down to 5%, which was more common rate that we've seen in other foundations and endowments. Senator Stedman.
Yes. So what you're explaining to me is we're using historical market returns of different asset classes that managed by the permanent fund, and depending on their asset allocation, how much is in bonds, how much is in stocks, or whatever they're investing in, we're using the historical performance and interaction between these and different economic cycles to gauge a future return and to ensure that the amount that we set to take out of the permanent fund is less than that, plus less than inflation, so we don't erode our future purchasing power. And we are looking at this structure leaving the permanent fund alone. In other words, we're not asking the permanent fund to change their asset allocation. We're taking their management plan as it was historically, as it is today, and we're taking a look at what that will produce, so we're not in a return, so we're not at this table then pushing them to get more returns so we can extract more money, so we can buy more goods and services or pay bigger dividends. Is that what you're trying to?
Yes, last year when the permanent fund representatives were here at this table, they did indicate that a 5% or a 5.25% would not change the way that the fund is currently managed and would allow the fund to maintain its ongoing concern. But I would like to note that there is a, while 5% seems to be the prevailing top end, there are funds around the world that have a lower draw. Case in point, our mental health trust fund here in Alaska, I believe 4.75. I think it's important to keep this draw amount in statute in order to allow the legislature the flexibility at any point in the future to lower that draw amount in the event that we have a financial need to do so. Senator Stedman.
Yeah, just help me again a little bit more of why we would take a portfolio, the benefits of taking a portfolio and using a 5-year or 6-year or 10-year, whatever, 2-year average look back, is that not to smooth out the amount of funds coming into either a budget cycle if you're running this as a endowment or a city, or in this case the state dividend stream or other stream of income for use of services that would give us a lot of it would give us predictability in that when we started our budget process we would know what that dollar amount is, and because we're using historical numbers, and it would also give us an advantage in smoothing if markets turned against us or went in favor of us, that it would not change much year to year. It would smooth out that trend and make our ability then to not have to change. If we had a down market, we wouldn't be having fairly instant pressure and pushing down our agency expenditures or shrinking the dividend or whatever we're going to do with it.
Senator Stedman, you are correct. Taking a five-year look back is a conservative approach, and it allows the fund to have more opportunity to grow over time by taking a five-year look back. We want to also provide a predictable fund or predictable draw amount, and by having 5 years, you have a whole year to know exactly what your draw is going to be. You don't have to wait until the current fiscal year is over to find out what the market value is. You're looking in arrears.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to just reiterate again, you know, this discussion we had at the table on SB 26 over the last couple of years, we've been talking about the draw amount that set in statute and how it rolls from 5.25 down to 5 on the. But there was some discussion from the last administration and maybe the permanent fund, I can't remember exactly, but because we have a predictable structured draw and allows them to invest accordingly, the permanent fund, that the effective rate could theoretically be 4.25.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. In a rising market condition, that is correct. So next slide. So the question is how is the dividend calculated now? There are three statutes that determine the dividend calculation. The first statute, Part 1, on the upper left hand, defines the statutory income which is used in the calculation, and it's the five-year trailing average of that income. Part 2 is you take that income, you divide it by 2, and then you transfer to the dividend fund. Well, actually, in Part 1, you multiply that by 21%. So you take the five-year, I apologize. Part 1 takes the five-year statutory income, and then you multiply that by 21%. Part 2 is you divide by 2 and then transfer to the dividend fund. And then Part 3 directs how the actual dividend amount will be calculated based on population. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this particular slide, but it is a three-part calculation based on annual income. Senator Stedman.
Income, is that fairly constant, or why is on the previous slide 2010 $1.2 billion in earnings reserve, and you're showing in 2019 $18.9 billion? Does that affect the dividend, ability to pay it?
So you'll see on this slide the sum of previous 5 years' statutory income, 2015, 16, 17, 18, 19, and you'll see a big jump from 2017 to 2018 from $3.2 billion to $6.3 billion. So what this does demonstrate is a very high, what we call high volatility, which means very big ups, very big downs, because you can see in fiscal year 19 we're back down to $3.8 billion for income. This makes it very large swings in the amount of the dividend, makes it very unpredictable, sometimes hard to predict what it might be. Senator Stedman.
Just a finer point on your previous slide, the year 2010 had $1.2 billion in the earnings reserve, the ERA account. And as I recall, in 2009, we were concerned at this table that there wasn't going to be enough funds available to even have a dividend. And there was concern at this table also that the permanent fund was being creative in their, or aggressive in their management of their assets to make sure that they had the funds to pay a dividend. And we had those concerns sitting here at that time. Now that has gone, you know, into the history books, Madam Chairman, but bull markets come and go, and when we had the bear market of 08 and 09 and 010, we had very little stability in the dividend. It virtually vanished. And if it wasn't for the creativity of the permanent fund itself, it would have been zero. So some of us were concerned that there was some politics involved in those years, especially a 1 year to create a dividend. And this explanation you were giving me on the previous slide would remove that. And we would have much more stability in our dividend stream. Isn't that not correct?
That is correct.
And if I could go on and add a little bit more, when you have an increase in financial markets, and it's, you can see that on slide one from 2010 all the way through 19, who knows what's coming at us. Markets go up and down, but clearly we've had a huge bull run or advancing prices in our equity markets mainly. That has swelled the earnings reserve and swelled the dividend. That also works in reverse. And if we went into a 6 or 8 year or a decade long protracted flat markets or economic decline, which has happened in the past several times in the last 100 years, we would have running the risk of having the dividend virtually disappear or possibly disappear for several years. So this concept that you're talking to us about today would remove that from the table. We would then have the smoothing effect being positively influenced on the dividend as far as having one. But on occasion, when we have a 10-year bull market, the dividend may be a little bit smaller. And then when we had a 10-year bear market, the dividend under this proposal would be bigger.
Thank you, Senator Seven. You're actually bringing me into my next point. So why is it that we're having this discussion today? So a brief historical perspective. The current calculation set of series of calculations that you see here on the slide was established in 1980 based on the annual earnings of the portfolio when the total balance of the fund was about $423 million. These calculations have survived nearly 40 years, but circumstances changed last year when we passed the POMV. Now we have a $60+ billion total value fund, and we passed a POMV last year where earnings are now just a component of the total market value. The goal is to take only 5.25% or 5% of the fund, excuse me, and never any more than that. No additional unstructured draws, no transfers, nothing. We want to protect the permanent fund over the long term, and that means we need to let it grow by not taking too much out in any given year. That was the whole reason why we passed Senate Bill 26, was to create a structured draw. And we've heard that time and time again from both the trustees as well as the president of the permanent fund, Angela Rodell, that a structured, predictable draw is what they've been asking for since at least a decade. What is the risk of leaving the dividend calculation as it is now? When dividends are just based on annual earnings, there is, as we saw and pointed out earlier, a lot of volatility in that, meaning the annual returns can go up or down a lot in any given year. When there is an extended, if there could be an extended bull market, the dividend could be bigger than the 5% of the total value, which risks devaluing the fund by taking more than the 5%, let alone providing nothing towards core government services at all. So why did we pass the POMV? The permanent fund was set up by our forefathers so we could save 25% of our royalty money each year and not spend it
so that someday the fund would be big enough to help smooth out our boom and bust commodity economy defined by oil. The oil would eventually run out unless we found new methods or new fields. That time came last year with declining production and pretty much no savings account left. After more than 2 years of discussion, we passed SB 26. The intent, again, of the POMV was to define the limit of how much the government can take from the permanent fund each year and still be fiscally prudent, meaning we don't risk devaluing the fund over time and instead allow it to grow. From this annual draw, the intent was to pay for our government services as well as allowing money for debt, retirement, and capital, and the permanent fund dividend. Since the dividend amount is now dependent on the total amount of the POMV draw, and if our goal is to stop haggling over the dividend for the next 40 years, as well as protect the permanent fund for the long term and don't take too much out of it to erode its value, we should start thinking about the split. Next slide, please. So the draw for this year is $2.9 billion. The split is merely just trying to decide how much percentage should go towards core government services and how much should go towards the dividend. And in order to help us decide that, we are going to look at two slides that illustrate the, both the magnitude and the interplay between the two. So pause here. Senator Steadman.
Yes, Madam Chairman. There may be a disappearance, possibly, of one of those arrows in the event that we do have, you know, favorable resource markets and we get into a point where we have a surplus on our reoccurring revenue or near surplus on our reoccurring revenue, which isn't out of the realm of possibilities. We would not need to draw to the core government services. We could actually, if we wanted to, leave that in the permanent fund to grow for our children and our children's children's, yet still pay out the dividend to the existing people. So I would just make that brief comment, Madam Chairman, that there's some flexibility in the one arrow. We are having some tougher times the last few years, but good economic times come and go, and we'll have some robust times in our future, I'm sure.
So thank you, Senator Steadman. That does highlight the fact that keeping the draw amount flexible so it can be something less than 5% in those good times is highlighted. In addition, this brings up, although we're not talking about this today, there is SJR-9, which is spending, or SJR-6, I believe, is a spending cap that the governor has introduced. And if we did have a spending cap, that would interplay with the POMV and the split. And if we did have excess earnings, that is another discussion another day in regards to what we would do with those excess earnings. Would we pay it towards, would we pay down retirement? Would we put it in savings? Would we pay a bigger dividend? Would we have a larger capital budget? What would we do with it? I don't want to go down that rabbit trail today. We will have that bill before us here soon enough. So next slide. So this is a demonstration of what we're doing now. This is undesignated general funds. This is the year that we're in right now. So you can see the permanent fund is the red line, followed by education, health, and social services on down. I have other government services such as debt, retirement, fund capitalization, and the UGF portion of capital on the far right. What this kind of gives you is a magnitude of how the dividend compares to agency funding. The permanent fund dividend in the current year that we're in now is equivalent to the UGF budgets for 14 agencies, and that would be transportation, safety, judiciary, administration, legislature, natural resources, fish and game, law, revenue, governor, labor, military, environmental, environment, and commerce. And there's even be a little bit left over to pay towards debt service. That's for a $1,600 dividend that we got this year. The dividend took about 37.5% of the total POMV for 2019, which, incidentally, I'd like to remind, did require us to take about a potentially up to $500 million draw on the CBR. It remains to be seen how much draw we're getting this year, but that's when we closed the budget that last year. Those were the figures that were used. Keep in mind, we've drained nearly $14 billion from our CBR over the last 5 years. So the next slide, please. Senator Stedman, I apologize.
Full speed ahead, but just listening to what you're saying. So on this slide, what you're telling me is we're going to draw, I think, a forecasted $600 million, and now, for lucky, maybe it's $300 million out of savings for this current year ending in the end of June, just to have the ends meet in the budget. We're going to basically draw $350 million out of our savings this year and in the current year. Just so I'm clear on what you're saying. Okay.
Next slide. So what this slide is as we build a budget, I feel it's important to get a feel of the budget cuts and the size of the permanent fund dividend. We should see how they interplay with one another. So just a basic guideline, for every $500 PFD check, it costs the state approximately $324 million, roughly, to pay it. So what this is this is a base scenario. If we take the current budget that we're in right now, fiscal year 19, current agency spending budget. Do you need some help, sir? We include fiscal year 2020 statewide expenditures and fiscal year 2020 expected revenue. Are you following me so far? We've got revenue that we look for this year, statewide expenditures, and that is debt service, minimum capital, and retirement, but we have the current year agency. You can see, starting at a 50-50, which is in the middle where the blue and the green arrows kind of meet, and you start with 60-40, 70-30 from the right to the left, you will see what the deficits are with each of those assumptions and what the PFD check amount would be. So for 50-50, if we split the POMV 50-50, we would have an $861 million deficit, and the check to be $2,343. It appears the state could pay about a $1,000 check with flat funding from last year. But the question is, do more cuts equal a bigger dividend? Should they? Could they? This is my personal opinion, that more cuts may not necessarily mean a bigger dividend, because it's my perspective that the state should leave some headroom and consider past underfunding of capital. We have leaky school roofs, damaged bridges, and aging infrastructure. So I'll pause here. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have concern about the confusion upon more toward the dividend. In slide two, you list statute saying 50% of the income is available under distribution under that statute. And so I haven't seen any statute or bills being proposed or discussions meaning more than a 50-50, because that would require additional statute to be passed to increase that. So I just feel that we're really only talking about 50-50 and less in terms of our discussion. I personally haven't seen any items greater than a 50-50.
There's no bills being introduced today that I know of, but I felt that it was important just to show the interplay both ways. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. I think it's important for the public to understand that Senate Bill 26 didn't really change anything. The legislature always had the authority to draw from the earnings reserve. It did put a cap on it of 5.25%, but the important thing to remember is we still have the dividend statute on the books. We still have a statute on the books that defines how much the dividend should be. If the legislature wants to continue to ignore that statute, they should change the statute. If someone wants to introduce a bill that says the dividend shouldn't be $3,100, it should be $1,000, go ahead and introduce the statute. Let's debate it and let's have a vote on it. But that has not been done yet. I think the legislature should follow the statute. And I think it's important for the public to understand that there is $1 billion in this budget that's going out of the earnings reserve to pay for government services. That's the equivalent of $6,000 for a family of four in Alaska. Every single Alaskan is contributing in this budget because the permanent fund is the people's money. The reason that the dividend was set up was because you had a system where the rich and the powerful and the special interests and the politically connected would come in and they would take an inordinate share of the government's wealth. And the permanent fund dividend program was set up so that it was shared equally, so that every Alaskan had a share. And that was a statutory decision. That was a decision that was made by the legislature. And if this legislature wants to change that, they can do that. But until we do that, I think we should follow the statute that's on the books, Madam Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wilkowski. Senator, or Co-Chair Stedman.
Yes, to the point earlier made that there's not a piece of legislation sitting in the table, that is true. There isn't legislation filed yet to restructure the dividend. The concept is being put on the table, showing some of the peril that the current structure faces, and to start this discussion, to head down that road, to try to come up with something that works in statute. We have, Madam Chairman, a substantial risk in having, like on slide one, we have roughly $18.9 billion, according to this, in the earnings reserve account, $18 billion, whatever it happens to be, 16, take your pick. We can spend it with a 21-11 vote. Some of us would be appalled at that. And we're trying to protect the entire permanent fund, not just concern that of the amount of the permanent fund that is constitutionally protected. We have concerns about the portion that isn't, because it's in billions, you know, starting to head towards $20 billion. And to then have that discussion with the public on if we change the structure, how do we, number one, protect the permanent fund from raids and excessive spending, and how do we put out a fair dividend stream to the public, who I would have to agree is the, you know, collectively we're the owners of the subsurface rights, and this portfolio, in my opinion, is a gift for future generations of Alaskans, not to be spent by us that happened to live through the oil boom years. And move these funds forward. So this graphic is just a depiction of if we were to split it in basically 10% increments, so the members and the public can get a feel for what the effects would be. For instance, if we took nothing and we took everything to the dividend, we'd have a dividend of almost $4,700. And we wouldn't be able to make our payroll. And frankly, the economy would go flat on its face. And it'd make the governor's or the proposed reductions in this year's budget look like chicken food. And then if we go the other extreme, we'd have a $600 million surplus and no dividend. Neither one of those is a solution. Somewhere in the middle. So the middle was 50-50. I figured that would be a good depiction, and to slide it up and down. Yeah. And with 50-50, Madam Chairman, that would be a dividend of roughly $2,300, as referenced on the screen, and give us still a deficit of $861 million before reductions, which this table has been very active in working on, trying to get there. And just speaking to the public, Madam President, we can't get, or Madam Chairman, we can't get $861 million in reductions. that, I can virtually assure you that when the operating budget is put together, even though every member of this committee has subcommittees and responsible for different portions of the budget, and every member, everyone, regardless of party, regardless of where they're from, is working diligently to reduce that number because we can't meet our payroll. We can't get 861. I, unfortunately, I'm going to have to tell the members that I can't get there. So what's going to be a number substantially less than that, and then we'll have the discussion here coming at the table. But we still have to pay a dividend, and we have to make our payroll. We have to balance those two out. And frankly, I think we're going to be looking at a multi-year step approach to get to wherever we decide we want to get to. If we collectively want to be 70-30 on one side or the other, or 60-40 one side or the other, or 50-50. Clearly, when we can close a gap of $274 million a lot easier than $861 million. But wherever we decide to be, or for that matter, if we want to be at 65-35, which would be about the $3,000 dividend, and that would give us $1.3 billion to cut and change. It's going to take multiple years to get there. But first, we need to know where we're going, and we need to start the discussion. So once we know that the direction we're going and the magnitude, we can start building these pieces and putting them together. But this cannot be fixed in 1 year at this table.
So thank you. I just wanted to make a comment that we are very fortunate to be having this discussion today, that we have money in the earnings reserve account, so we could have these discussions, whether it should be 50-50, 60-30, 60-40, 70-30. Because if we do spend down the earnings reserve account in the next 5 years, then 50-50 or 60-40 of nothing is nothing. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Stedman said we need to protect a raid on the permanent fund. I'm sure he meant a raid with a simple majority on the permanent fund earnings reserve account. There is no way that we are going to raid the permanent fund, and that is not the intent of this committee, and we do not have that authority.
Senator Hoffman. Chair Stedman.
Just a point of clarification, probably too quick with my verbiage, but clearly the constitutionally protected portion, which is reflected here in the corpus on slide one, at maybe $47 billion, that's the numbers used, and then the $18.9 billion is the earnings reserve. That's where the danger is. All it takes is spendthrifts in the administration, spendthrifts in the legislature, and that money's gone. We walked through $14 billion here in the last half a dozen years. We can walk through another $14 billion by not dealing with this issue head on. So what we want to do is block the raids of the permanent fund and protect it for future generations. Permanent from earnings reserve, make the entire permanent fund guarded.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate the discussion today. I think it's important. I think there are other options, though. I think one of the options that we haven't talked about is one that I know is politically tough, but it is an option that needs to be looked at, and that is the issue of oil taxes and the question of whether or not we're getting our fair share for our resource wealth. It's something that we've debated for years. I don't think we are. Governor Jay Hammond said we should be getting a third. The Fed should be getting a third. The producers should be getting a third. We're nowhere near a third today. We're half of a third. And so I think that is an issue that you can get $800 million. You can get more than $800 million, quite frankly, if you start getting our fair share for our resource wealth. And I hope that this body will take a serious look at that issue. I know we've had some hearings on it, and I appreciate that. I think it's something that we need to address sooner rather than later, though.
Senator Machicki.
Madam Chair, I thought we were talking about the conceptual issues with the POMB and the permanent fund and the permanent fund dividend calculation today. I thought it was conceptual. I thought we were just basically talking about the effects and how it works. So if it's time to start launching on how we feel about how things should occur in every aspect of the budget, I can do that. Is that what we're doing today, Madam Chair?
Senator Bertschicke, thank you for your comments. Today was more towards the conceptual aspect of a split and the permanent fund dividend and how it's calculated. Fortunately or unfortunately, sometimes there's interrelated subjects that can be brought in and are brought in. And it is the committee's will to discuss however you want to go for the next 10 minutes or so on the slides that you see in front of you.
Okay.
Senator Bertschicke.
I'm not going to go there because I don't think that's what we're talking about, although the total state take last year was closer to 44% in oil and gas. I just want to make sure we don't leave things on the record that are categorically untrue. But let's get back to the subject of the discussion. And I'm happy to talk about oil tax adjustments so that the public can understand that. I hope we get more into that discussion in the future. But today's discussion, I wish slide 4 would have had the statutory to the far left, which would have been $2 billion last year, $751 million higher than education, $850 million higher than Department of Health and Social Services, because that helps put this discussion into context. I know it's the slide is about what we spent. Slide number 4, if you can go back one more. The slide is about what we spent, but I think it helps the public to understand the enormity of the challenge and the size of the statutory dividend, which many Alaskans support. I think it specifically brought us a governor. What I want to do is, I know this is unusual, but Senator Stedman, you said that we could not get those cuts in 1 year. And I get lots of emails from folks that support the governor's budget, which seem to deliver those cuts in 1 year. Why do you, if that's okay, Madam Chair, why do you say that we can't get those cuts in 1 year when we have a budget in front of us that to some people seems to deliver that level of cuts?
I haven't, or for those watching at home, I'm responsible for the operating budget for this year, next year. So basically, play a referee amongst all the members and as we put the budget together. And the budget components have been assigned to each individual member, including minority members at the table. So the direction is to make sure the state stays solvent. And everybody's working hard on those proposed budget reductions. By the time you do the adjustments for taking money out of savings, which we don't want to do unless we have to, and then we want to clearly delineate it and make it very clear what we're doing, or we don't transfer the burden onto the municipalities, and I'm gauging the political winds of the building on that, and then looking to each committee member on what they are, you know, trying to deliver, and they've been working with, for those at home, working with the departments, in conjunction with the departments, very diligently. Everybody's trying to deal with this issue. Most of the departments that you see up on the screen here have really small little blue bars. There's not much room in them to reduce them. And we've got Department of Education, which Senator Hoffman's working on. We have Health and Social Services, which Senator Von Imhoff is working on. Senator Hoffman's also looking over the university. And we have corrections and DOT. DOT is where the Marine Highway is. You can see if you eliminate the Marine Highway, that bar's not very big to start with in the scheme of things. It doesn't turn the system around. So I am going to bring back the recommendations from all the individual members, but there's little likelihood it's going to be anywhere close to $800 million.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. the last 3 years, I was a strong proponent of Senate Bill 26 that addressed the draw and addressed the split, among other things. But I know members that were in our caucus last year got tired of hearing me talking about we need to adopt provisions of 26, and in the end we did that. But I want to talk about something that Senator Wilkowski talked about, is the statute for the dividend, you know, I think that we need to talk about the governor's talking about is a constitutional dividend and what that may be. And I bring that up because I think that is the essence of the problem that we're facing today. We look at a statutory bill that we have for the dividend. Governor Walker reduced that amount, and we did not follow it. We did not override him. In fact, subsequent years, we went ahead and ignored the statute. And I bring this up in light of another issue that has been before this legislature and before the public, and that is the length of time the legislature sits. We passed a constitutional amendment for 121 days, and in subsequent years we passed a statutory limit of 90 days. We might have honored that for 1 year, but basically we as a legislature have ignored the statutory time limit that the legislature could sit for 90 days. And I assure you that we are going to ignore that again this year. So my point is that we may talk about a statutory change to the current bill. We may ignore it, but then the dividend becomes the issue of discussion year after year, year in and year out. And guess what gets the most attention? In the budget process, it's what is going to be the dividend. And if we do not resolve the issue on a permanent basis and let the people of Alaska decide what that might be, we are setting ourselves up for decades to come to be making the dividend a political discussion for everyone's election, for lieutenant governor's election, and for gubernatorial governor's elections, because guess what? We will continue to use that item and potentially ignore the statute on what a dividend will be, and that is going to be the basis of just about everybody's election. So I agree that on this table that you had before us on page 5 needs to be discussed, but I would say that it would be a great mistake if we make a statute change that can be ignored, just like the 90-day session that this legislature and governors before have not brought that to our attention, and we've ignored it consistently. And I think we are going to ignore it for years to come. And that is my position. I know people have strong feelings about what should be included in a constitution, and this does not rise to that level. But unless it is addressed as something that the people could decide upon, the bigger issues that face this state are going to fall to a lower discussion standard at this table and in the legislature.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. So I believe that you have roughly 55 villages around your around Bethel. So are you saying then that 56 villages, so each with their own school and each with their own runway and other state services, are you saying that you'd rather put the dividend in the Constitution than, I don't know, education, health care? Is that what you'd like to do?
I'd like to resolve the issue once and for all so that we as a state do not fight about what should be education, what are we going to spend our money on, all these other things, because the one issue that's going to rise to the top of the political agenda is going to be the dividend. It rose to the top this year, and I believe that we will never be able to discuss other issues such as additional revenue that can address education, address roads, and address all the other issues that are going to face the state. So I would say we will not be able to address those issues that affect my community in the state legislature because the elephant in the room and the discussion is always going to be what is going to be the dividend. So I'd say that, yes, we need to clear the tables and let's resolve this as a state so we can move forward on runways for my communities, for education for my communities, for education for everybody at this table's concern, because if we don't, they will not be addressed. Thank you.
Chair Stedman, Senator Bishop.
Sure. So let me just kind of tee off Senator Hoffman's comments, and I think they're good comments. I think we need to kind of take it in steps, or one bite of the elephant at a time. And the first bite is to put the concept on the table, and then the second bite, frankly, we have a draft bill, but we've got to refine it to put it on the table, and then we can't get it to the voters until next general election in 2 years. So it would be nice to get something in statute, so the public can see what it is. So when they go to the polls and push the button, they're well informed and they're not voting on a concept, but they're actually voting on something that is in statute. They could see how it works. They know why, they know what the good and the bad points about it, and they make an informed decision. So we can't take it to the voters here this Friday. We have to wait till the election cycle comes around. But we need to have something, I would agree with Senator Hoffman, in front of the voters, but we need to make sure it's refined in our process and the public sees exactly what it is, because these are big multi-generation decisions we're asking the voters to consider that affect their grandkids and the generations that aren't even here today yet. So I would have to agree with Senator Hoffman. We just need to kind of do it in steps, and we needed to get the concept on the table, and I thought it would be better to throw the concept in the middle of the table than write a bill and put it in the middle of the table, because putting the concept, we might be able to adjust the bill and refine some of the discussion then and make it more pointed as we go forward. But we'll have some lively meetings, Madam Chairman, coming as we look at our future generations of Alaskans, and hopefully when it's all said and done, they'll look back in history 100 years from now and 50 years from now and realize we made the right decision, and we didn't do it. Senator Hoffman said, just kick the can down the road, ignore the statutes, and loot the permanent fund. So they end up with nothing but the constitutionally protected portion.
Senator Bishop, followed by Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be brief. I'd just like to leave a little lighter note here on the table. How many other states in the union would like to have $66 billion in the bank at their disposal? Think about that. So we're not broke. We've got $66 billion in the bank today. We've talked about numbers of 80% of the way there last year by passing SB 26. And the other part of this is considering how we're going to come to conclusion on the draw amount. And then we will have finally solidified a second stream of new revenue to the state and the power of earnings, a renewable resource. Thank you.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I haven't said anything yet. To be quite frank, I wanted to say exactly what Senator Hoffman said, but he said it far more eloquently than I could have, so I'm just going to echo that I agree with his sentiment about a solution that's going to keep it off the table for politics. And we should be arguing about where we're going to spend our money, not how much we have. It would be nice if that's the boat that we were in, where we could just discuss that. So without taking more time, I'm going to say that I echo his comments. But there's a couple other things I want to talk about, because like I said, I've been very quiet so far. One of my gravest concerns is the statutes, which he already alluded. Anything that isn't statutes, we tend to have we ignore them when we choose to. So anything we do can be simply ignored, and I think you'll find that the people don't trust us that way. And that is a fundamental problem with government. If you don't believe that your government is going to actually do what they say they're going to do, and we don't follow the very laws that we make, that's a problem. And I think that's a problem we have seen, and I certainly heard that last year in the campaign trail. And so that is an issue. I would also highlight that a few other things on the slides is that, you know, I think you would hear from my district at least a basic guideline on slide 5 at the top. For every $500 PFD check, the people would say that's a cost of the people, not a cost of the government, because we did redefine this from designated funds to unrestricted general funds. And now it is something that we can put into play on the table for government spending. And then the last thing for now, and I'll be quiet because time is short, is that spending reductions. We're talking about constitutional, statutory, and other obligations that we have. And I think other has risen to a level we've had money for a long time, where we've been able to spend it how we chose and somebody else was paying for it. And the rooster is coming home to roost, and we now have to deal with what we have available. This is the discussion, and I appreciate what we're doing here. I want to make that clear, that this is a discussion about where we're going forward. However, when we talk about these various levers we can pull, spending reductions should be on the table, and I know that they are, and we're discussing those. And that's why I appreciate that, to find out where we can end up right now this year. But that has to be an integral part of this discussion, because otherwise, the rest of the numbers, they don't matter much. If we go to the budget that we had before, then it's crystal clear. We're not going to have enough money, and we're going to spend the earnings reserve down. So we're trying to find a better path. I appreciate that discussion, but I do think that this has become a political hot topic, and we need to find a better solution for the long term. Or like Senator Hoffman said, we're going to be arguing about this for decades. Thank you.
Thank you all for being here and staying here for a couple hours and being part of this conversation. I will leave you with this. Anything, if you put the dividend in the Constitution and financially obligate future generations, it could have grave consequences in the future that we will wish that we will not be we may not be forced to pay a dividend. When you look at the cost of everything and the value of nothing, it gives me pause. And what I'm hearing is some folks saying that they value the individual over the community. And with crime and safety being such a big issue, and education and teachers, and educating our students and our young people for the jobs of the future, as long as they have, it sounds to me, a $3,000 dividend, it doesn't matter whether there's teachers or village safety officers or troopers. I'm very dismayed personally hearing some of the comments here today, because I value both the individual and the community. I value balance between core government services and the dividend. And I value a sane and reasonable size of government that also values the workforce here in our state, our natural resources, all of it, and not just skew it one way or the other, and certainly not putting it in the Constitution. Anyway.
Wait, before you go, do you have an announcement?
Affirmative Fund dividend application deadline is Sunday, March 31st. Just put lemon juice in my eye. That concludes today's meeting. Thank you, Bert. Our next meeting will be tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. The Department of Natural Resources, Permitting, Leases, and Land. We are adjourned.